Okay, our first case today is case number 76582 in the matter of the William J. Raggio Family Trust. Let's see here, we have Mr. LaForge representing the, okay, I don't know if that was coincidental or whatever, but go ahead and put it back up, not a problem. I'd like that. So Mr. LaForge and Mr. Mowry representing the real party in interest. Thank you. Justice Perigary has recused from participation in this case, so it will be decided by a six-member court. Mr. LaForge, do you want to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, sir. At least 5 minutes.
Okay, well, we'll mark that on the calendar. You'll hear a little noise at 5 minutes, but you know, if you keep talking, the clock will continue to run. So just kind of shut it down as soon as you can when you see the 5 minutes, and you can get reserved the time then. Okay, why don't you go ahead and proceed?
May it please the court. The real issue in this case is whether Dale, the trustee and beneficiary of the marital trust, is obligated to consider her other assets and resources in making a distribution under that trust. Specifically, does she have to consider her access to the credit shelter trust, to which she is also the beneficiary and trustee? We think the legislature has directly answered this question in NRS 163-4175, which provides that no, a trustee does not have to consider the beneficiary's other assets or resources unless the trust instrument expressly provides otherwise. The district court and plaintiffs claim that that exception to 163-4175 is satisfied by the inclusion of a single word in the marital trust section 5.1, and that word is necessary. They believe that you can't determine what's necessary for her support without considering her other assets and resources, specifically the credit shelter trust. But that can't be. The first problem is that that argument misreads the role of the word necessary in section 5.1. If you look at it, I'm going to use the demonstrative now. The word necessary modifies the amount of the trust to be used in the disbursement. It doesn't set a threshold condition for disbursement itself. That's set by the bottom part of section 5.1. The question there is, does the disbursement properly fit within one of these three buckets? Is support, care, and maintenance?
I want to pause you. You're leaping right ahead to the merits of the ultimate outcome of the case, and there's a threshold issue here, which is this is a writ asking us to interdict an order allowing discovery of non-privileged, arguably private information. And you would be well advised to also address the propriety of writ relief on this basis. I'm concerned about whether this is diving straight ahead into the deep merits of this case is appropriate when the district court judge has yet to vet all of that.
Yes, Your Honor, I'll address that right now. I understand this comes in the posture of a discovery order, but ultimately, discovery on this issue isn't going to change the outcome here. What's before the court is a purely legal issue that involves construction of a statute and a trust instrument, both of which is de novo.
But if as a matter of precedent, we take writ relief in this case, any time somebody sets up a motion to compel and the other side says, this is not under the old rule reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence, under the new rule, slightly different standard relevant to a claim or defense, it's not proportionate to the discovery, et cetera, those are invested in the district court to make those determinations. There's summary judgment, there are other procedures that can be utilized, but I'm concerned why we would take writ relief and dive to the merits on a relevance objection in a discovery case. And what, you know, it's the opening the door, the slippery slope, right, what have you. Our precedent on discovery, interlocutory discovery writ review is usually, not always, but usually, where I'm being directed to reveal something that's privileged and the district court got the privilege assessment wrong. It's that kind of irreparable injury, and I'm not seeing that here.
Understood. The writ standard is whether it's a blanket order with no regard to relevance. There's no question that this is a blanket disclosure.
I think there is a question. Is that a blanket disclosure? The district judge, Judge Hardy, has ordered some information to be provided. It isn't, give me everything you have under the sun. It's, what disbursements did you make out of the secondary trust, if any? I forget the name of the second trust. Pardon
the
me.
The ultimate question is relevance, which has to be reasonably calculated to lead to admissible evidence. And evidence isn't admissible if it's only relevant to an invalid legal claim. And I don't think Nevada allows you to do discovery on invalid claims, and you shouldn't be able to shoehorn your way into getting confidential claims.
Can't we address that at the end of the case after a final judgment, though?
Well, let's say, for example, that I sue poor John here for legal malpractice, and I immediately ask for discovery on all his billing practices and records. That's confidential information, but it's relevant to a legal malpractice claim. Problem is, I've never been a client of poor John here. Should I be entitled to make him disclose that information early on, or do and wait for a dispositive decision on this legal issue?
But wouldn't John then be entitled to make a motion for summary judgment? I mean, he's a very capable lawyer. He could say, this guy's never been a client. I don't know what claim he has against me.
The motion for summary judgment doesn't stay discovery.
I understand that. But nonetheless,
once it's ruled on, it does.
Yeah.
Once it's ruled on, but I guess the question is, what is the procedural vehicle in which to stop discovery on an invalid claim at the threshold?
But your point, counsel, apparently is that by permitting discovery in this instance, the court has effectively resolved the summary judgment of the legal question.
I think that's a good point, Your Honor. I think this may be the law of the case, effectively, that we have to read the two separate trusts.
Regardless of the discovery that's ultimately produced, and regardless of the summary judgment, all of the issues surrounding the interpretation of the statute were vetted in front of the district judge. So the issue basically has been decided for the rest of the case. Is that your point?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so, in effect, this is a case resolution decision, unlike some other situations in which discovery is requested and there's some if or doubt surrounding the interpretation. Your position is that this is a legal question, and if the trust interpretation is contrary to that which the district court gave it, the discovery should end.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
So the court denied the summary judgment motion on that issue, correct?
The summary judgment issue was brought on the grounds of res judicata, which is slightly different.
There's
some overlap, and so you'll see discussion of 1634175 and the word necessary.
I thought there was a motion for partial summary judgment on this issue in this case.
That motion argued that the notion that there was a proportional spin down had already been decided by the probate commissioner.
Right. I looked at the summary judgment because I was trying to in evaluating the propriety of writ relief. My understanding is you were arguing some form of claim or issue preclusion based on an earlier ruling, but not directly these issues.
Okay. That's correct.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Did the court make a ruling on the legal issue?
It did, effectively. I mean, it denied the motion to compel, which was based on this. And in its motion denying partial summary judgment, it expressly held that the word necessary is sufficient to satisfy the exception in 163.175.
That's an interlocutory ruling that you can press a district court to revisit in light of new issues, new law, more thorough vetting. You can still make a motion for summary judgment. A discovery ruling is not cast in stone. I mean, as a litigator, you would persist in pushing that point, wouldn't you?
Of course, Your Honor, but again, I think it's the law of the case, and the court has established its interpretation of the statute and the trust, and so we're essentially asking the court to reverse its previous decision.
And the discovery order is discretionary with the district court, correct?
Well, I think...
It has a legal component,
to be sure, but in general, whether to allow discovery as relevant as opposed to privileged presents...
Right, but the danger there is that we have to disclose what we shouldn't have to disclose. We have to disclose irrelevant information and then ask the district court to change its mind on an improper legal ruling that relies and hinges on a purely legal issue.
But if, I mean, it just seems a little odd or for have this court in a position of trying to rule on the legal interpretation of the statute and the trust and how it applies when the district court hasn't even done that, hasn't made a ruling on that issue in the first instance.
I think it has in its motion for summary judgment order. And I grant you that that's very confusing because that analysis really should have been made in the motion to compel or order. But the motion to compel order is just a summary order, motion granted.
Right.
I don't see why...
The summary judgment order looks like, and I'm on page 4, I believe, of that order. It says, it appears possible this court cannot determine what is necessary and proper without a complete understanding of the trustee's circumstances to include standard of living and supportive resources beyond the marital deduction trust.
And that's directly relevant to the motion to compel on this issue before you now.
Mr. LaForge, did you want to reserve the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Mallory.
Good morning, Justices. I am, first of all, as the court is already aware and has pointed out, we are here on a petition for extraordinary writ to deny discovery as to the status of distributions that have been made on the same discretionary standard as under the marital trust or the subtrust of the William J. Raggio Family Trust. Discretionary distributions that Dale Raggio, as trustee, is on both sides. And it's our contention that we believe that, first, the discretionary distributions she has taken from the marital trust, which are $20,000 per month since Mr. Raggio's death, exceed the standard of living and that she was accustomed to when Mr. Raggio was alive. So that is at issue. A secondary issue concerning the discovery into the other trust, this credit shelter trust or the subportion of it, which, by the way, started life twice as large as the marital trust. That one had almost $5 million in it. The marital trust had approximately $2.5 million. She has spent down the marital trust now at the end of last year to $1.3 million. We don't know what has happened with respect to any distributions made to her from the credit shelter trust, again, on that same discretionary standard. But we believe the remainder persons first are different in each of these. The remainder persons under the marital trust are Bill Raggio's two daughters, who are both here today. And it is in the record. It's not a secret. There is animosity between Dale Raggio and Bill Raggio's two daughters, Leslie Raggio Righetti and Tracy Chu. So there is an issue here as to bad faith that we believe if we get the proper evidence, we're going to be able to show that Dale Raggio acted in bad faith. Part of that are the distributions from the credit shelter trust. The remainder beneficiaries of that trust are Dale's grandchildren. They were not related at all to Bill Raggio. He only met them a couple of times.
Mr. Mallory, I think we understand, or at least I do, your arguments and the background you've provided. But isn't your right to discovery dependent upon whether the term necessary is used in the trust fits within the exception of 163.4175?
It's not just necessary, Justice Hardesty, but it's also proper. Both of those words.
Necessary and proper, but your discovery request is entirely dependent upon this court's assessment or the district court's assessment of the meaning of those terms as an exception to that statute, right?
No, and for this reason. Let's just assume hypothetically, I've told you what she has drawn down from the marital trust. Let's assume that she has made no distributions to herself under the credit shelter trust. Again, twice the size of the marital trust. That, to me, is circumstantial evidence that she has violated her duty of impartiality with respect to the remainder beneficiaries of the subportions of the William J. Raggio Family Trust. She is favoring her grandchildren at the expense of the Raggio daughters. We're of the opinion that this is a plan. This was planned. She wants to effectively disinherit the Raggio daughters under the guise of being the trustee and under the guise that she's pulling down the money from the marital trust as necessary for her proper support, care, and maintenance. So, on the other hand, if we are wrong that the distributions, she has in fact made distributions to herself from the credit shelter trust, then we have to look at the standard of living. And there is a breach of fiduciary duty there because we already believe the $240,000 that she has pulled down annually from the marital trust exceeds the standard of living when Bill Raggio was alive.
But there's a central legal question here, Mr. Mowry, that has been briefed here pretty thoroughly. And that legal question is whether or not the trustee of the credit shelter trust is required to consider her other assets and resources in connection with distributions made from the subtrust to which your clients are remainder beneficiaries. And that, too, is a legal question on which your discovery depends, right?
To some extent, I would submit that it's still relevant. It's still relevant as to her standard of living.
Well, they're not legally permissive. If she's not legally required to consider her other assets or resources, as the authorities that have been cited to this court suggest, then on what basis are you entitled to this discovery?
How is it relevant?
Because
of the possible breach of the duty of impartiality, if she has not pulled down any of that money, and we believe that it's circumstantial evidence a possible bad faith directed towards our clients.
What do you make of the statute that says specifically that unless the language of the trust exempts otherwise, the trustee is not required to consider any of these resources of benefit? It seems to be pretty clear that that language limits your access to these claims.
Your Honor, it shouldn't. First of all, let me address the merits of it. The cases that are cited by the opposition in their papers only use the word necessary. We have cited other cases from other jurisdictions, Massachusetts being one of them, the Supreme Court there, and I believe Connecticut was another, where the words were necessary and proper. In addition, of importance is a lot of the cases that are cited by the opposition have additional language in the trust instrument that indicate the settlor's intention was to benefit the surviving spouse at the expense of the remainder persons. If you read those cases carefully, you'll find that. Admittedly, it's very difficult to synthesize all of the authorities. And I would also cite to the court,
throughout all of those cases, both those cited by yourself and those cited by the other side, the ultimate question, the fundamental question, in fact, our own authority has said historically, it's the intention of the testator or the trustor, right?
Yes.
So I guess your argument would be that there's some question surrounding the intention of the trustor in interpreting necessary
and proper. Yes, I think that is a question that needs to be decided. And there's no doubt that Bill Raggio intended to provide support for his wife, widow, Dale Raggio. He gave her $1.8 million outright, and then he has her being the life beneficiary of these two trusts, of which was this coordinated estate plan, and she, but if she is drawing down from the marital trust at the expense of the Raggio daughters and to the benefit of her grandchildren, she is favoring her grandchildren. And I know if you look at the third restatement of on impartiality, and this court cited the third restatement on the in the Connell case dealing with impartiality, a fairly recent decision. Excuse me. It says that when the beneficiary is also the trustee, there is a heightened scrutiny that needs to be applied to the distributions made to the beneficiary. And that's, when I stand back and I look
you
at it.
You consider that to be totally independent of the authority that says that if necessary is not considered an exception to the statute, that you nevertheless have an impartiality claim.
Yes, we have an impartiality claim because of the coordinated estate plan. I would cite the court, and I believe it's in our papers, to Section 50 of the Restatement Third, Comment E, has an example right on all fours, which I'm happy to read into the record if that would be of assistance to the justices.
But isn't the larger point that until we know what the facts are, we don't know what's truly in play? I mean, that's the problem. I don't know what legal issues you truly need to litigate here until it's laid out. You may have no support for your restatement, comment E section. Let's say she was supporting herself out of both in equal measure. Until you know that, we don't know whether it's fish or fowl.
Agreed. Justice Pickering agreed. And it would be our contention. Either way, we need to see what the pattern of distributions are from that credit shelter trust. And she may very well have other resources as well, which gets back to the accept
language.
Has
there been any discussion of a confidentiality order that would allow this discovery to proceed subject to a confidentiality order?
It is certainly not privileged information.
Right.
And we have heretofore not been given what I'm going to call the source documents dealing with how she is justifying the $20,000 per month to be in her accustomed manner of living. All we have gotten
that at this point.
No, it's been refused. We only have what we're told is she's the trustee. She made the decision. So, and these are her categories that she wrote out, and go away.
So, counsel, this was before the district court last year, before the changes were made to the rules of civil procedure. And so the discovery ruling, which is what's actually before us, is a discovery ruling, was made under the old standard, which was reasonably calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. Is that your understanding?
That is correct.
Okay. And so tell us why this discovery is reasonably calculated and why the district court got it right on that.
In part, Dale Raggio as trustee is vested with ordinary discretion, not with extraordinary or extended discretion, which is defined under Nevada law and has some magic terms, some of which you will find in Bill Raggio's trust instrument, but not with respect to the role of Dale Raggio in connection with her duties as trustee of these trusts. And because the Nevada statute, which I can cite to the court, don't have it right at my fingertips, indicates that if a trustee is vested with extended discretion, a trustee can only be held accountable for bad faith, dishonesty, the like. By negative implication, ordinary discretion, which is what Dale Raggio is vested with, means that she has to act reasonably. And that is, there's a case this court decided, Mulroy, I believe I'm probably mispronouncing that recently, about negative implication. So the question is whether she's even acted reasonably in the way that she has gone about her duties. That is partly why we need this information. And again, it's under the restatement at least. on impartiality, the beneficiary trustee, the decisions, and the administration of the trust, including distributions, are to be looked at with heightened scrutiny.
So, has the district court made a ruling on whether this case falls within 163.4175 or not?
No. No, not so far as I recall. It was certainly something that we argued about at the hearing before the order came forth for the allowing discovery to proceed. We talked about necessary and proper, and I still stand by the proposition that if there were an independent trustee, a retail trust company, or a national association with trust company powers, that trustee, assuming that there are no distributions coming out of that credit shelter trust, that trustee would not do that.
But Senator Raggio obviously made the decision not to do that and to appoint Dale to be a trustee of both of these trusts. What do we make of that?
He did, but he did not relieve her of her duties as trustee to act in good faith, fair dealing, loyalty, impartiality. She has the mantle of the office. Those duties and responsibilities go with her. You'll note, as I mentioned a minute ago, in the incapacity provision for Senator Raggio, it talks about when his successor would come in to take care of him, absolute discretion. We don't have that here. We just have ordinary discretion. So she has to act in good faith, reasonably. And we need the information because we think if the facts are as we believe them to be, that they are circumstantial evidence coupled with other evidence that we're aware of that show bad faith, a plan here really to disinherit the Raggio daughters. I see I have a red light.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we'll go ahead and Mr. Forge, if you'd like to proceed with your rebuttal, you have about 4.5 minutes here left.
So it's acknowledged that the plaintiffs have no right to information under the credit shelter trust under their own ordinary set of circumstances. What they claim is that Dale abused her discretion because that she was in some way, as trustee, obligated to disperse the marital trust and the credit shelter trust in some relationship to one another. That's a purely legal issue. And you can assume, for the purposes of the argument today, that discovery is going to show that Dale took 100% of her needs out of the marital trust and 0% out of the credit shelter trust. It doesn't change the result because there's nothing in the trust and there's nothing in the law that commands a trustee in Dale's position to somehow consider a separate trust. And this ultimately turns on the trustee's intent as expressed in the trust itself. Senator Raggio's sole expression on the relationship between the two trusts is found in section 4.1 of the trust. And there he states that upon his death, his estate is going to be divided into, quote unquote, two separate trusts. Senator Raggio's only commentary on the relationship between these two trusts is that they were separate. I'm sorry, Justice, did you have a question?
Sorry, yes, I wanted to let you finish your thought. So what does it mean to say necessary for the proper support, care, and maintenance of Dale? Does that have any meaning, or does it just mean whatever she feels like?
No, proper, I think, is the gateway question. That determines whether a disbursement should be made. And again, the question is it properly fit within one of those three buckets of her support, care, and maintenance? If so, then the next question is, in the trustee's discretion, is the amount necessary for that request? That's giving meaning to both those words in their context and not construing them. And I'm not alone here. We've cited no fewer than 7 different state Supreme Courts that have construed analogous provisions and come to the same conclusion about the word necessary. And there's only one case that addressed proper. We cited it in our opening brief, and it also rejected the idea that that word somehow creates a condition that requires the trustee to consider other assets.
I looked at most of those cases, and none of them came up in the context of a discovery dispute on an extraordinary writ. I mean, I'm not sure where I would come out at the end of the day on this, but I trust Judge Hardy to, if you file a summary judgment or he finds issues of fact that go through to trial, to make that determination thoroughly vetted, well-briefed. It would, I mean, the briefs here are much more extensive than what was in the district court on the discovery dispute. And I think there's a value in that process. I just worry that we're shortchanging ourselves and the parties.
Well, I think the problem there is that it makes parties produce irrelevant evidence first and then litigate it afterward.
But you can file a motion for summary judgment.
That does,
and they'd have to do a 56F. I mean, there are procedures for this.
And I guess we're at that point, we're essentially asking Judge Hardy to change his mind, because he's already made his decision and expressed that. And there was a lot of oral argument on that issue, admittedly, in the motion for summary judgment argument. But it's been addressed.
That wasn't what was written in the summary judgment motion. That was pretty much a, you call it res judicata, but collateral estoppel.
And so I think if you don't grant our writ, the problem is we're going to end up litigating this issue three times. We litigated it once before Judge Hardy previously. We're litigating it for you now, and there's a very good likelihood that this is going to come back up to you on a direct appeal later on. I think judicial efficiency says that this purely legal issue should be decided here and now.
So a writ is extraordinary relief. Like, why does this warrant extraordinary intervention instead of, like everyone else, waiting till you have a final judgment?
And the standard is it an abuse of discretion? I would say his grant of the motion to compel, considering our arguments, and we raised that argument, was an abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. LaForge. Thank